On The Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is The Murder Squad.
A 12-year-old girl disappears in Usseton, Washington. A 22-year-old woman went for a 30-mile bike ride before residents find her remains dismembered in trash bags in the Snake River. Two sisters go out for groceries and to do the laundry. The remains are found 2 years later off a rural highway. And a 35-year-old man disappears after returning to his place of work in Lewiston, Idaho.
None of the cases sound connected on the surface. But throughout the investigation, detectives come across one person who potentially had access to all of them. Police have spoken to him on several occasions. But he said that he has no knowledge of any of the crimes and he's refused to take a polygraph. Our job? To find the killer or killers of Kristen David, Christina Nelson, and Brandy Miller. And to find Christina White and Stephen Pearsall.
This is The Murder Squad. So, Billy, what's the weather like out there?
The weather is hot.
Yeah.
It is hot in Los Angeles, California. And of course, this is a dirty secret that you may or may not know as podcast listeners, but we are always podcasting without air conditioning. So oftentimes we are incredibly hot and incredibly sweaty, just so the so Stephen won't yell at us, but more importantly, so the sound will be good. So we just want you all to know that because the sun is blasting into my window. But we do this for you.
You know, I'm rather fortunate because it's warm here for this time of year for Colorado, and it's sort of in the mid 70s, and I'm in a basement, so you know, my office here is not too bad, so I don't need to All worry right. about the air conditioning.
So we have an update. A lot of listeners after the case from 2 weeks ago, which is Kevin Kluwer and Brian Booth, talked about the possibility of Toronto serial killer Bruce MacArthur. While there's no evidence linking Kevin and Brian's cases, it's an interesting possibility. Now, as you know, MacArthur is currently serving 8 life sentences for the murders of 8 young men. He was a landscaper. He found his victims in this place called The Village in Toronto from 2010 to 2017. Some of them he dismembered and then planted pieces of them in his client's yard. So, you know, I would guess that investigators have looked into MacArthur for a bunch of other crimes. The MO is also not similar, but you know, we, of course, are going to pass along that information over to Chicago and New York.
Yeah. What's the Village out there in Toronto? Is that a nightclub scene?
No. Yeah, it's sort of it's the gay village. So it's LGBTQ plus and, you know, a lot of great bars and clubs and things like that. And that's where what this guy used to find his victims.
OK.
Yeah. So and similar to what we were talking about with Kevin and Brian, who were also in locations that had a lot of gay bars.
Yes.
So I think that's a reason why a lot of people wrote in about him.
Yeah.
But for now, we're going to go to Washington State and Idaho. In April of 1979, 12-year-old Christina White lived with her mom, Betty, and stepdad, Mick, in Usseton, Washington. The area was part of the metropolitan region known as Lewiston-Clarkston, or the Lewis-Clark Valley. It's composed of Nez Perce County, Idaho, and Usotin County, Washington. The area includes Snake River, which, as any child of the 70s will remember, that's the river that Evel Knievel attempted to jump over in a steam-powered rocket in 1974. Paul, do you remember that?
Well, actually, you know, I was going to bring up, you know, back in the day, as a young child, I had one of those metal lunchboxes that was Evel yes. Knievel jumping over the Snake River. So I've got, you know, I've got a very nostalgic connection to that. He failed. He failed on that attempt, right?
It did not make it. Now, yeah. It was a rocket. It didn't work. But I remember having the Evel Knievel that you could remember it was him on the motorcycle and then you could right. wind it up and then it would go. Fantastic toy. Okay. So, but that's Snake River. In 1980, it had 46,000 people total in this area. So Christina was excited to go to the Ossetin County Fair. The fair came every year towards the end of April. And on Saturday, the 28th, Christina attended the parade that marked the opening of the fair. And she went there with her mom and her sister. After the parade was over, the family went to Christina's friend Rose's house on 2nd Street. Christina had her bike with her, and it was a 10-speed. It was white, and there was a basket in the front of it. She was supposed to go to the fair with Rose to help her with her horse and then ride her bike home. Betty watched her daughter enter Rose's house before she and Christina's sister went home. Now, Rose lived with her mom and her mom's boyfriend. The two girls go to the fair. Around 2:30 p.m. or so, Christina starts to not feel very well, and she thought it was heat stroke because that was something that she had experienced before. She went back to Rose's house and called her mom. And her mom, Betty, told her she couldn't pick her up right then, and she told her daughter to put a wet towel on her neck and rest. And then after she felt better, she would call her mom again so she could watch her daughter walk the last two blocks of the 7-block walk home.
But Christina didn't call back. Initially, Betty thought her daughter must have gone back to the fair. Betty went to the fair later that afternoon to pick her up. Christina wasn't there. Ossetin had a fairly new police chief at the time. He'd only been on the job for about 6 months and didn't have any training. He and his officers used spotlights to look all throughout the area. The police at first thought maybe Christina was just out riding her bike. But no one believed she ran away. It wasn't something she would do. Not to mention, she had big plans for the summer months that included baseball, camping, and a month-long trip to her dad's in Payette, Idaho. That night, Rose's mom's boyfriend offered to help the police search. He told the officers he had gotten Christina a wet towel when she came home from the fair not feeling well, but he hadn't seen her since she left the house. The next day, the search continued. Christina's dad, Gary, had come to help with the search. His friend owned a helicopter service, so air searches were also done. Gary told Clue, K-L-E-W, everyone was just running around like a pile of ants. Nobody knew what they were doing. There was no organization to it or anything. There was no sign of Christina or her bike. The terrain also made the search difficult. They had no witnesses to point them in a specific direction. The area is rugged. It wasn't easy to access with a vehicle. According to Detective Jackie Nichols, the area is easy for people to disappear in.
Now, Paul, no one saw Christina leave Rose's house. How would you go about directing people to the most likely areas? You know, you've got the search team, you've got some volunteers. Where are you? And it sounds like they didn't do a sophisticated grid search. It sounds like they were just haphazardly doing this.
You know, this is a 1979 case. This, as far as I know, is before there's any type of real child abduction protocol. You know, so in essence, this inexperienced police force is just left to its own devices, and they are dealing with a difficult terrain. You know, in this day and age, with a 12-year-old girl, you make the assumption that there is something that, you know, foul play has occurred. But the first thing you have to do is search the last location where she was seen, which is over at Rose's house. You have to do a thorough search. You have to do a thorough interview of everybody inside that house, in addition to staging people, patrol units at various locations along any of the primary roads leading away. The search itself being as undirected as it was, with a difficult terrain, I would imagine probably 80% of the geography nobody looked at. Even, you know, with helicopters, you can only see so much from the air. You know, you're not going to see a little girl. You're not going to see a bicycle if they're in, you know, the forest and being hidden by the brush. Mm-hmm. This search does sound like it was haphazard. She would have been easily missed if she had just, let's say, gotten lost on her ride home. But you also have to consider, and in this day and age, it's automatically assumed until proven otherwise, that potentially something bad has happened to her, that somebody has abducted her.
So investigators began to look into people who interacted with Christina before she disappeared. Now, remember the boyfriend who said he gave her that wet towel? It was a boyfriend who lived with Rose. It was Rose's mom's boyfriend, and he was of interest. He owned another house, and that house was vacant at the time. And that house was actually located between Rose's house and Christina's house. But they still couldn't tie him to Christina's disappearance. And we are not naming his name because the police have not named his name. But the search continued. A few weeks later, a call came in from a man named Carl Flynn. Flynn owned a farm west of the area. Inside his pasture, he found a bunch of school papers scattered. The papers were in good condition, and he could read Christina's name on them. Flynn thought the papers couldn't have been out there for longer than a day or two, so he called law enforcement. Law enforcement continued to look into Rose's mom's boyfriend. Based on his work records, he wasn't at work the day Christina disappeared. The vacant house he owned had an unfinished basement, and later concrete was poured on the floor. Austin sheriffs brought in cadaver dogs and ground-penetrating radar in hopes of finding Christina. There was a suspicious area in the basement noted by the radar, but after the dig, nothing was found. Now, Paul, with the ground-penetrating radar, are we actually seeing something on a, you know, what was it looking like in 79 versus now? Now you can actually potentially see an outline of something, but back then, no, right?
Well, you know, I, in terms of ground penetrating radar from, 1979, 1980 timeframe, I'm not sure what kind of printout it was. And in fact, I imagine it was likely either on one of those monochrome computer screens, you know, the green type of screen.
Yeah.
Or it was literally, you know, ribbon paper, sort of like a polygraph instrument, you know, where in essence, you know, as the radar is registering its readings, a needle is tracing, you know, the strength of the reading. And then, of course, you have to have an expert that's interpreting, you know, what that printout means. And, you know, I will tell you, even with modern GPR instrumentation, I mean, they do find anomalies, but I'm not entirely convinced that they always find grave sites. And even though they ran dogs in this basement, I go back to, I think it was in Cleveland with Sal, the serial killer. And they ran dogs in his backyard and there was no hits. And when, with further investigation, they went back and they found four bodies in this tiny backyard that the dogs missed. Dogs are a tool, but they are fallible. They're great in some instances. So now I have concerns about if they just went after a little blip off of, you know, antiquated GPR technology, what was missed?
Yeah. So the man actually put his home up for sale. And right around the time they did that, law enforcement got another tip. Supposedly a woman had visited the home to possibly buy it. And apparently he was very excited to show her the basement. And there was a documentary called Cold Valley. And according to that documentary, the woman was walking down the stairs to the basement and turned to face the man. And when she turned around, she said he was holding a piece of a bedpost that he reluctantly showed her after she asked repeatedly, like, what is that? Then he asked her how many people knew she was there. And she told them, several people know I'm here. And then he said he no longer wanted to show her the basement. So this, coupled with the things that we were talking about, coupled with the fact that he was one of the last people to see her, there's a lot of things looking good for this guy.
Yeah, you know, this behavior, I'd want to know the context of this woman coming forward. You know, she reading this in the newspaper, was this a high profile case? You know, how much is she invested in helping out and in finding the 12-year-old girl? But you know, her coming forward and relaying this type of behavior that this man is doing absolutely is suspicious. That coupled with him being the last one, you know, at a certain point, you know, this is alarm bells are going off. And I think for these investigators, alarm bells were going off. But even with this new tip, there was no evidence to connect him to Christina's disappearance. The case made a small rural town go from never locking their doors to a community on edge. Just over 2 years later, the Lewis-Clark Valley would have another missing person case. This time, 22-year-old University of Idaho senior Kristen David disappeared. Kristen called her mom, Sally, on June 25th, 1981. She said she was going to ride her bike from Moscow to Lewiston the next day. Her plan was to leave around 10 or 11 in the morning. Kristen assured Sally that she'd be home for work. At 6 p.m. on June 26, Kristen's work called her sister. She hadn't showed up. The family immediately went to the police. Kristen would never not show up to where she was supposed to be. Law enforcement was worried. They told her family, college-age people take off all the time. They refused to search for Kristen for 48 hours. But Kristen's family knew better. They started their search that evening. They walked the roads Kristen would have taken on the 30-plus mile bike ride. The family searched in ditches and empty buildings on the pass. There was no sign of Kristen or her bike.
Now, Paul, we've got a map of the two routes that she could have taken. Anything sticking out for you in these routes?
Well, you know, primarily we know that there's a fair amount of terrain along these routes, and it's the distance. It's 30 miles. And now, right now, the search is limited to the family having to drive along 30 miles to look for Kristen. Now, if Kristen had just, let's say, wrecked on her bike and was laying there injured right there off the side of the road, that's one thing. At her age, you would think that, you know, the chances of her, you know, getting lost and then being well off the roadside into, let's say, a wooded area is unlikely. If the family completes the search and doesn't see her and says, you know what, she didn't just wreck. Now, this is where you have to get more resources in order to search the 30 miles, you know, plus, you know, out off the beaten path, off on other trails. And then also consider the possibility that maybe somebody picked her up. And unfortunately, the family was just left to its own devices here.
Yeah. So police finally start their investigation. They talk to Kristen's neighbors and they heard her take her bike down, which meant she'd at least started the ride. Within a few days, police tracked a call that had been placed to paramedics on June 25th. There was a farmer named James Archibald, and he was on U.S. Highway 95. He says that he saw a brown van with Oregon plates. It was parked on the side of the road. He saw a man get out of the van and walk to the back of the vehicle. On the ground behind the van was a woman with blonde hair. She had a bike with her, and the back wheel was still spinning. Archibald said it looked like the guy, quote, drove up right beside her and drove right into the side of her and pancaked her and kicked her, knocked her over there, and she just absolutely was not moving when I went by. He said the man was smiling as he was walking. Archibald called the paramedics when he got home. Remember, this is 1981. There are no cell phones. When the paramedics arrived on the scene, there was no van, there was no man, there was no bicycle, there was no woman. Law enforcement tried to track down the van, and Archibald did give a description of the man for a sketch. He said he was 25 to 35 years old. He was under 6 feet and around 150 pounds. But even with this sketch and the van details, the lead went nowhere. Now, Paul, taking a look at this sketch, the man is wearing kind of aviator sunglasses, so you can't see any of his eye features. He's got a beard, and he's got a sort of a regular kind of haircut, straight and parted to the side. Anything else stick out?
No, you know, and I think it's also understanding how much weight to put on the veracity of this sketch. Here you have a witness that's literally driving by and probably is getting just such a momentary look at this guy. Is how much of the features is he really taking in? And he's not able to relay any of this until he gets home. He calls, you know, in saying, hey, you know, I saw this woman who looks hurt to the paramedics. And then at some point after that, now law enforcement's responding and recognizing, you know, we've got an issue here. You know, so it's days later before this guy is able to relay these details. You know, I think, you know, fundamentally, it's, you know, it's a guy that looks like he has a full head of hair and a full beard with mustache and wears glasses. But in terms of, does it narrow down, you know, to something that is useful? Not really. You know, that's yeah. that's the frustrating part. If he just had a cell phone in 1981, right?
Well, yeah, it's that. And also as far as a brown van. Now, we don't see a lot of vans around now. Vans were a really big deal in the late 70s, early 80s. We've spoken about that on this program before. And then also the DMV and searching for particular, you know, a brown van in the area was not as sophisticated as it is now.
No.
And also, we're talking about a U.S. highway. It'd be rough just to find, you know, a brown van. And a brown van is one of those things that if you're not a car guy, you're just going to say it's a van. And then you have to go through, okay, who makes a brown van? Does Chevy make one? Does Dodge make one? Does Ford make one? Which were the three big manufacturers at the time. And then you'd have to go through, you know, who makes brown and the color, what kind of color it was. There's a way that they could have narrowed it down a little bit, but then, you know, you get to the point of, okay, was this even this guy's car?
Yep. Nope. Yep. Absolutely. Or whether or not the brown coloring, the paint job was stock or whether it was aftermarket.
You know? Exactly. Yeah.
So now on July 4th, the search for Kristen ended. A man was fishing on the Snake River when he saw a trash bag floating in the water. He fished it out and opened it. Inside was a headless human torso and leg, both wrapped in newspaper. He looked for more bags. 75 yards downstream, the same man found another bag with other remains. It was late in the evening when the fisherman called the police. Law enforcement came out the next day because it was already dark when the report came in. Three more bags were located. Each contained body parts, a dismembered head, arms, and part of a leg. All were wrapped tightly in newspaper. The bags were found in a 6-mile section of the Snake River, a half mile west of Chief Timothy State Park. The cause of death has never fully been revealed. Early news reports claim she'd been stabbed multiple times, but authorities never confirmed this. But in the Cold Valley documentary, coroner Peter Martin did say it was the worst homicide he'd ever seen. He said the body had been dismembered with a knife by someone who knew how to take things apart. Every injury was done with a purpose and knowledge. He didn't believe the killer was an amateur. He clarified it looked like a hunter or butcher, but not a medical professional.
So let's talk about this disposal method for a second. Wrapping tightly in newspaper, there's something to that. I have my ideas, but Paul, why would somebody wrap the body parts in newspaper?
Well, you know, that is a little bit interesting, you know, because here you have the coroner, Peter Martin, talking about, you know, he didn't think it was a medical professional, but a hunter or butcher. And when you see how, let's say, a butcher processes meat, what do? You know, they end up wrapping the pieces of meat in paper before it's ultimately packaged. It does leave a little bit of an evidentiary trail in terms of, you know, if you got newspaper that can be traced to a particular geography, a date, you know, in which the newspaper was printed, if it's there, you know, so it's a little bit unusual then, and it's somewhat unnecessary. If the offender had access to the garbage bags straight off the bat, why not just put the body parts into the garbage bag? Why take the time to wrap them in newspaper?
Right. You know, one of the reasons why you might use newspaper is for just to be cleaner. And because you know that this whoever did this might have dismembered the body. We don't know if they would have drained the body of blood, but they very well could have wrapped each body part tightly in newspaper just to make sure that there would be no leakage out of the newspaper, as opposed to just putting it in a bag.
Maybe an additional layer is what you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And this tightly wrapped, you know, I'd be kind of interested to see, well, exactly what does that wrapping look like? You know, is this, you know, like if I were to wrap something, it would look so amateurish. I would just be folding this thing around and just kind of, you know, crunching, you know, the ends together, sort of like I wrap Christmas presents. Did this look like somebody who had a certain level of skill in terms of wrapping newspaper around objects such as meat?
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of potential clues here. I think it's the wrapping. And if the wrapping was obviously, it was tied up somehow. Was it tied up with a string or was it tied? We don't know this. Or was it tied up with tape? There definitely could be evidence on that. And then when we get to the actual newspapers itself, where was the newspaper from?
Yeah.
You know, and what newspaper was it? So there's a lot there.
Yeah. And one of the things I'm really liking about what the coroner is saying here is he, you know, how often do we hear about cases with dismembered body parts that, oh, the person must have had medical training? And here you have somebody saying, no, you know, it looks more like a hunter or a butcher. I mean, there are other experiences and skills that people learn over the course of their life that allow them to have, you know, some level of expertise on how to dismember an animal, which includes a human. And that's what I like, because so often, oh, he must be a surgeon. And then you look at what was done and go, no, you know, I mean, a reasonably smart person or a hunter or a butcher could potentially have figured this out. Or somebody like a Jeffrey Dahmer, who is dismembering animals as he is developing into a serial killer and learning anatomy, even though he never was formally trained.
So between Kristen's apartment, where she rode her bike, and where the remains were found, the area encompassed four counties and two states. So imagine that, you know, we got six different jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. The FBI eventually took over out of their Salt Lake City office, and all evidence from the case were sent to their office. So they were going to be the clearinghouse. The details of this case have been put into VICAP, and Kristen's case has actually been compared to other cases in California and Oregon. A year later, the Lewis-Clark Valley would have yet another case, and many wondered if it was related to Christina and Kristen's cases. Twenty-one-year-old Christina Nelson and her stepsister, 18-year-old Brandy Miller, were both attending Lewis-Clark State College. Christina had worked at the Lewiston Civic Theater, and Brandy participated in many of the functions there. On September 12, 1982, Brandy and Christina were planning on going to the grocery store and to do some laundry. Christina talked to her boyfriend around 8:30 p.m., then the two left him a note before they headed out. The young women didn't return home. The next day, Christina's boyfriend reported them missing to law enforcement in Lewiston. Now, with their ages, again, police thought that maybe they just took a trip. They searched Christina's apartment. Nothing was amiss, but both women had left their purses and wallets. Police also found the note Christina had written the night before.
Within just a few hours of the missing person reports of Christina and Brandy, another missing person report was filed, this time for 35-year-old Stephen Pearsall. He was the janitor at the Lewiston Civic Theater. Stephen was friends with Christina and Brandy. He was like a big brother to them. He also spent a lot of time at the theater, even when he wasn't working. It was a place of solitude and peace for the former U.S. Air Force corporal. On the 12th, Stephen had gone to a party with his girlfriend. Around midnight, his girlfriend dropped him off at the theater. He is planning to practice his clarinet. She watched Stephen enter the theater. So did an officer who was on patrol in the area. The initial thought of law enforcement was that Stephen must have had something to do with Christina and Brandy's disappearance and then fled. Law enforcement thoroughly searched the theater. There was no sign of a struggle, but Stephen's clarinet was still inside.
So what do we think about Stephen as a person of interest in this case?
Well, you know, he has to absolutely be considered. Here he is. He's being dropped off at the theater. He is friends with Christina and Brandy, and he does go missing. It doesn't appear that there's anything that, at least on the surface, based on what they did inside that theater, to indicate that anything happened to Stephen himself. So they're going to kind of look at that, you know, and from this area to have three missing people within such a short time, of course, law enforcement is going to go, okay, something's up, because they all know each other. So it's like a triangle that's going on here.
Yeah, there's something there. And remember, I know that everybody's probably yelling at their car radios and while probably yelling while you're out on a hike, for everybody that's out on a hike, that this is, we're talking about the unfortunately named golden era of serial killers in the big hotbed of serial killing, which is the Oregon, California, Pacific Northwest area. So, we got that. Yes. Stop yelling. You're going to disrupt people on the trail. But after detectives talked to Stephen's friends, the theory that he was involved didn't seem to hold up. He wasn't a violent guy. Plus, Stephen had left his car. It was parked at his friend's house. And when they searched the apartment, police actually found an uncashed paycheck. So it started to become clear that Stephen probably didn't leave by choice. But law enforcement still thought the three disappearances were related. the women would have had to walk by the theater on their way to the store and to do laundry. They may have seen Stephen, or Stephen may have witnessed their abduction and been at the wrong place at the wrong time, like he tried to intervene and then something happened.
Sure.
Police did uncover another employee present at the theater the night of the 12th. You'll never guess who it was. It was the same man police suspected in Christina White's case in Washington. Remember Rosa's mom's boyfriend, the one that gave Christina the hot towel. Lewiston police interviewed him, and they said that he couldn't make eye contact and he fidgeted. According to his interview, he said that he arrived at the theater around 6 p.m. He said Stephen arrived around 7:30 that evening and then left around 9 p.m. Around 10 p.m., the man went to Red Baron for a few beers. He then went to the movies and watched the movie called The Fog, which is a horror movie. After the movie was over, he said he returned to the theater, and he said that was around 11 p.m. He claimed he did some work once he got there, and then he said, quote, "Can't remember if I did much on the stage, but I needed to do some rigging. So I went up in the loft, up in the attic up there. I took a fall." Apparently, he'd fallen through the plaster. After that, he felt like he needed to rest. So in his words, "I went back downstairs and lay down on the couch and stretched out. I had a medium case of the shakes. I just laid there and dozed off." The police asked him if he heard or saw anyone after that. He said he heard the phone ring but didn't answer it. Then they specifically asked him about Stephen, and he said, quote, "No, I have no notion that he even came into the building as far as I know." So this timeline is interesting, and the things that jumped right back at me are, at 10, he goes to the Red Baron for a few beers, and then he goes to the movies to watch The Fog, and then he comes back to the theater at 11 p.m. That's a really, really tight timeline, and he's not watching the entire movie then.
Yeah, you know, and taken into the context of he's at the theater where Stephen was last seen. You know, so this is a big deal in terms of, okay, so what's going on here? You know, his timeline is goofy, and he's also present when Stephen's girlfriend drops him off so he can go to the theater to practice the clarinet. The clarinet is found inside the theater. Stephen makes it inside where this guy is at, the boyfriend, who we can't name. So again, this is like, you know, when I am thinking about, hold on, this is the guy who last saw Christina, hands her a towel, and he is being interviewed to assess whether or not he's responsible for this 12-year-old girl going missing. And then now, several years later, he is at the location where we have Stephen going missing, plus two friends of Stephen who possibly walked by that location. And you have a woman coming forward saying that this guy creeped her out, basically, because he followed her down to his basement with a bedpost as if he was going to whack her in the back of the head when he had the opportunity. If, you know, she had isolated herself and nobody knew she was there, you know, so things are starting to stack up here.
Yeah, really. Red flag after red flag. And it's kind of similar to Christina White's case where he offered up giving her the towel, you know, him saying that he was there. You know, had he not said anything, they might not have known that he was even there. So he might have this thing where he gives a little bit of information just so he can place himself maybe at the scene, just in case they find something of his or somebody had seen him at the scene. But there was a reason why he was there. And then he kind of, you know, disregards everything else.
It's feeding just enough. You know, when you create a lie, you want enough truth in it to make it seem plausible. You know, but there is no direct evidence to tie him to Stephen's case, just much like Christina White's. The case went cold with no sign of Christina Nelson, Brandy, or Stephen. Then, on March 19th, 1984, a teen in Kendrick, Idaho, stumbled upon skeletonized remains. They were down an embankment near mile marker 14 on Highway 3. The remains were badly decomposed. There was clothing and personal items found with them. Also nearby were cords similar to clothesline. The skeletonized bodies belonged to Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller. The clothesline cord pointed back to the theater. It was the same cord they used on the pulleys for the curtains. It made law enforcement want to talk to the other co-worker, Rose's former boyfriend, again.
So on March 22nd, 1984, Lewiston brought the man back in. The detective told him they'd found Christina and Brandy's remains. His reply, "I guess I'm in a heap of trouble." That's what he said. But now his story changed this time. Now he said he got to the theater at 3:30 p.m. or so. Steven still showed up between 7 and 7:30 and left around 9, but the man's trip to Red Baron was now at 9 instead of 10. He still said he went to that movie and returned to the theater around 11 p.m. Again, he said he did some work, but this time he added the detail that he moved his gold 1972 Camaro around the theater to load up his tools. Then he said he fell asleep on the couch. Now, this new sequence of events included waking up around 5 a.m. He said his wife had called. That's when he started to drive home. But he decided to go back to the theater to call her instead. Police talked to his wife. She said this was the first time he'd ever not come home or called. They also checked out the movie he claimed to go see. The movie ended at midnight, not 11. Now, this is the movie The Fog. It's John Carpenter, Jamie Lee Curtis, Janet Leigh, Adrian Barbeau. It's a film that you're not going to just leave in the middle of. So this was probably also a lie. It ended at midnight, not 11 p.m., the time he told investigators. So many things are stacking up against this guy. But again, he says he didn't see anything or hear anybody that night. They asked if he'd ever been arrested. He said just once. Said it was June 1972. He was taking a shortcut through a funeral home parking lot in San Jose, California, and one of the neighbors called in to report a prowler. According to the man, the charges were reduced to a misdemeanor. No big deal. But it wasn't really the truth. The Cold Valley documentary was able to discover what really happened. Inside the funeral home was the body of 17-year-old Antoinette Anino. The man had broken in with a knife, a flashlight, and a camera. And the owner of the funeral parlor actually caught him. And what did the man say? He said he just wanted to see his girlfriend one last time.
Oh, my.
Antoinette's death was suspicious. She was at the boardwalk when she got into a fight with her actual boyfriend. So the guy that we've been talking about, Rose's mom's boyfriend, this wasn't her boyfriend. This was just an excuse he gave to the funeral parlor. But she got into a fight with her actual boyfriend. They went down to the beach. The boyfriend returned to the boardwalk without Antoinette and said he waited for her to calm down. The boardwalk closed and Antoinette hadn't returned. Her body was later found and authorities believed that she had drowned. But her body was nude except for her watch and necklace, and her clothes were never recovered from the beach. Lewiston police asked the man if he was being truthful. He said he was, to the best of his recollection. Then they asked him if he would take a polygraph, and he replied, "I don't think it would be in my best interest to do it." So, a lot to unpack here, Paul. Breaking into the funeral home with a camera and a knife, changing the story multiple times, changing the timing, refusing a polygraph. What do you do at this point?
You get a warrant. That's what you get. I don't know what the original investigators did, but again, as I said earlier, things were stacking up on this guy. And now, in 1972 in San Jose, California, he was arrested for trying to break into a funeral home so he could see this body of a 17-year-old girl that he wasn't the boyfriend of, even though that's what he gave as an excuse. I'm now looking at this from a behavioral standpoint. You know, here is somebody that I think is possibly having fantasy related to dead female bodies. He's probably fairly young in 1972. He's not self-confident enough to go out and get his own victims. So what he's doing is he's doing the next thing that he thinks is going to satisfy his fantasies, and that's breaking into this funeral home to look at a female body. He's got a knife with him. What is he going to do to that female body? Is he going to cut into the body? He's got a camera with him. Does he want to record this for posterity's sake so he can fantasize over and over about what he did to this dead female body? The behavioral aspects of a fantasy motivated predator from that case alone is just, you know, the alarm bells are going off inside my head. And when you start stacking everything that, you know, he's the last person to see the 12-year-old girl alive. He was at the theater when Stephen went missing. Stephen, who was friends of the two women that went missing, whose skeletonized remains were found, I think it was a year and a half or 2 years later. I mean, you start looking at this and now he's offering up. When he's at the theater, the night that Stephen went missing, he had to take tools out to his Camaro. And like we said earlier, you know, there's going to be some truth to his lies. Was he taking tools out to his Camaro? Or was he taking bodies out to his Camaro? I'm now tracking that Camaro down. I'm getting a warrant. And that warrant is not only looking for evidence related to Stephen, but is related to these other cases. And I think there is sufficient information that a judge would find that I would not be overly broad to say, hey, I want evidence. We know these bodies were inside a car. They were transported to other locations. He owned a Camaro, at least when Stephen went missing. And I'd verify that that Camaro was something that he owned when the 12-year-old girl went missing. I now want to search that vehicle for any and all evidence, and I'd have to articulate what that is, in order to see were those bodies of these homicide victims present inside this Camaro.
Yeah, and you know, the only good solace with that is we're talking about 1984. He's still driving a 72 Camaro. It's one of those cars that, you know, cars back then lasted, you remember, they lasted 4 years, unless you really took care of them and it was going to be a classic and you were going to keep it as something, you know. So having a 72 Camaro in 84 meant that this thing might be sticking around for a while. It might even be still around.
Yeah, you know, and most certainly, and I've done this myself, and this is what I would, you know, strongly suggest is track that vehicle down today. Does it still exist? Hopefully it hasn't, you know, wasn't crushed into a cube and, you know, chopped up, but it's now, you know, in somebody's garage and hasn't been, you know, completely overhauled. Maybe it's just been maintained, and it's possible you start pulling back floorboard carpeting. You start looking underneath seats. Maybe there's some hairs that were caught on bolts. You know, something like that. Even after all these decades, there is the potential for evidence. It's a long shot, but it's definitely worth going after.
With no direct evidence or a confession, they, again, were not able to arrest this person of interest, and the case stalled. Investigators throughout the years have looked into other possible leads, including serial killer Robert Yates. Yates operated out of Spokane, Washington, about 2 hours north of Lewiston. But the victims don't fit the usual victim profile. Yates preyed on sex workers from 75 to 98. He shot his victims in the head and disposed of them in rural locations. While several local detectives believe all of these cases are related, not everyone agrees. The FBI has been given access to all of the files. Profiler Bradley Garrett said he could see a connection possibly to Christina White, Christina Nelson, Brandy, and Steve, but not with Kristen's case. It was a completely different MO. So, Paul, we do know the name of this person. We're following our own rules by not naming this person's name. But because you had worked in that area, you know, he potentially, you know, he was in San Jose.
Yeah.
You've got the name. You're going to check it with your files.
Yeah.
And we're going to try and kick this thing off a little bit to get some answers here.
Right. You know, this, with everything that has been brought forward, you know, in all these cases, you know, he has, and I've seen coincidences, and I've seen just absolutely crazy coincidences, and so can't 100% say that this guy is responsible for any of these crimes. However, the totality of the circumstances, everything should be done to try to determine whether or not he is responsible for any of them. And I would even include Kristen's case, who was run off the road on the bicycle by the man in the brown van. And even though the FBI profiler, Garrett, and I completely respect his expertise, you know, I know from an investigative standpoint, you know, his opinion is something that I utilize as I move forward in investigation, but I don't necessarily eliminate this boyfriend as possibly being involved. I've seen too many cases in which the offender's MO can change dramatically. And if he seizes upon a victim of opportunity, a 22-year-old woman who's isolated herself on this 30-mile bike ride, and he's looking around going, there's no cars around. And now he takes the opportunity to run her off the road, and then he grabs her and her bicycle and drives off. I see the same offender being capable of doing that case, as well as abducting a 12-year-old girl, as well as abducting Christina Nelson, Brandy, and Steve. I've just seen it. They do deviate from what you think their primary MO is.
No, we saw that with Rodney Alcala. We saw it with all of these guys.
Absolutely. You
know, they don't completely stick to an MO. Even Bundy, you know, Bundy didn't stick to an MO always. You know, you always think about Bundy talking about how he was pretending to be hurt. Can you help me with my boat? But he also did break into that sorority house, you know, which is a completely different MO than from the before.
And his last case, who was a 9-year-old girl. Right. And that's what's so important. And I know we've talked about this before, but this is that crossover offending where everybody thinks, oh, if they only attack adults or, you know, that's all they do from a victim selection standpoint. No, these guys that primarily attack adults every now and then will attack a younger girl like 12-year-old Christina.
Yeah. And also, if some or all of these are the same killer, it's incredibly likely that they have other victims, too.
Yeah,
you know, in other locations, wherever.
Right. You know, and there's just so many red flags about the background on this. This is where, you know, as I became more familiar with this case and I saw the San Jose connection 1972, I've got a relatively comprehensive list of individuals that were looked at in the Bay Area from that time frame. And I am going to take a look to see if this guy's name has popped up in any of the cases that I was involved with out of the Bay Area from the early 1970s, at least.
Yeah. So that brings us to our weekly assignment. Now, like we said, it's unclear if all these cases are related. The only thing that's linking them at this point is the area. Now, that man, that person of interest in Christina White's disappearance and the Lewiston Civic Theater did often drive the road that Kristen was biking on. But let's review this information. 12-year-old Christina White disappeared on April 28, 1979. She was last known to be at a friend's house on 2nd Street in Usseton around 2:30 p.m. She was 5'4", 135 pounds, wearing blue jeans, red leather sneakers, and a tan and pink striped shirt. Her ears were double pierced. She has brown hair, hazel eyes, and she'd be 54 now. 22-year-old Kristen David was abducted and murdered on either June 25th or June 26, 1981. Most likely somewhere along U.S. Highway 95 between Moscow and Lewiston, Idaho. Her remains were discovered on July 4th. She'd been dismembered. The remains were found wrapped in newspapers in 5 trash bags, and her case remains unsolved.
21-year-old Christina Nelson and 18-year-old Brandy Miller disappeared on September 12, 1982. The girls had left a note they were going to Safeway and to do laundry at a friend's in Lewiston. Their remains were discovered in March 1984 near Kendrick, Idaho, off Highway 3. The case has never been solved. 35-year-old Stephen Pearsall disappeared on the same day in Lewiston. He was last seen entering the Lewiston Civic Theater around midnight. He was 5'11", 160 pounds. He has brown hair and brown eyes. There was a scar on his left calf and a scar on his left arm. He was wearing a beige velour long-sleeve pullover sweater with horizontal stripes, beige ski jacket, and beige pants. He had a blue cloth duffel bag with him. He would be 72 years old now. If you have any information on any of these cases, please contact us.
That takes us to the rules. We didn't name this name, but we are going to dig heavily into it. You guys, please do not name names in public. Don't dox each other and be nice. And that takes us to the weekly distraction. Paul, I'll go first this time because I have been very distracted, particularly on this week because playoff hockey is back at Nassau Coliseum. I wish I was there because it's the last time the Islanders will ever play at Nassau Coliseum. And it just reminds me a lot of going to the games with my dad. The arena is so loud and they finally been able to get it to like 93% capacity. And the place is, you know, it literally does. It shakes. Yeah. So I've been watching from afar and thinking about my dad and stuff. And that's definitely what's been distracting me as the playoffs normally do. But it's great to actually have the Islanders in there.
Yeah. And what a great memory to have. And, you know, obviously exciting times from a playoff standpoint. Now, is this the arena where they throw the octopus, or they used to throw the octopus out there?
No, that was Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. And you would throw the octopus because it used to be you only had to win 8 games to win the Stanley Cup. There was only 2 rounds of playoff series. So you have to win 8 games to win the Stanley Cup. And so technically you would want to throw 2 octopuses. But, in Detroit, I believe they still do throw the octopus every now and again. But there's other places, you know, Long Island, as far as playoff tradition, the Islanders started the playoff beard, which is you don't shave during the playoffs. You only shave, when you get knocked out. So that was the Islanders that did that because you just want to feel as grimy and dingy as you can. That's what the Islanders did. But, you know, there's other places. The Florida Panthers would throw not live rats, but they would throw fake dead rats onto the ice.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great traditions in the National Hockey League. So.
Oh, wow.
And hockey in general, you know, not just the National Hockey League, but just all over the place. So one great thing about hockey, because hockey players and hockey fans are always a little bit slightly askew and anything to be weird. And yeah, let's just bring, you know, and people like the thing is, like 10 people will bring an octopus. It's not like one person. It's like, okay, I'm the octopus guy. Uh-huh. After a while, a lot of people started bringing those octopuses. So you had a bunch. I remember once, I think Detroit got shut out and then somebody just threw it on the ice, like during the game, like in this, because it was probably stinking underneath their seat. And they were just like, just get this thing away from me and just throw it on the ice. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
it's an interesting, tradition and,
yeah, you know, even though my home state, I guess technically is Minnesota, I've never glommed onto the hockey scene yet. You know, and I think the Minnesota team just relatively recently got eliminated. I saw that, but one of these days maybe I'll learn the sport.
One of these days we'll go to a game. We're gonna go to a game.
Sounds good. Well, you know, my distraction is going to be something up your alley, sort of, is that a show that I've previously watched and I'm revisiting is the show Lost. Oh. I initially got into that show because my oldest daughter got hooked into it when it first aired. And now, you know, I've got a younger set of kids. And so we're showing them, you know, the Lost, because they're old enough to be able to see it and understand it. So we just finished season one. We're not really binge watching it. We'll watch like one episode a night, or, you know, one episode every few nights. But it's interesting because even though it's not super old, it's still a little bit vintage in many ways. And it's still so entertaining, even though I know, you know, what happens at the end and how, you know, many people thought that how disappointing the ending was. It's still a fun journey.
Now, do you have a favorite character?
Oh, you know, in some ways, I would have to say Locke after season one, just because he's so surprising in terms of his skill sets, from being somebody who, at the beginning, you know, couldn't walk. And now he's somebody who's either a survivalist or a special ops guy, and then Kate, You know, I've always been fascinated with this fugitive aspect of, you know, Kate, who can act so demure at times, but then the badass aspect of her comes out.
Right. Fantastic. Okay. Thank you, everyone. You know what? There's going to be no, I know you all waited for the password, but we don't want to milk the password. So we're not going to have a password every day. I will say if there was a password, it would be humidity, because this house, I can't wait to turn on the air conditioner.
But, yeah, he's just dripping sweat right now, everybody.
Anyway, please rate, review, subscribe. It's great. You know, whenever you leave a review for us and you write something down, it actually helps us a lot and helps more people listen to the show. And hopefully somebody hears a story about a case and we'll pick up the phone and try and solve it. So that's super important. Follow us on our social media channels. We've started to post a little bit more stuff on there. And that's about it. So until then, keep digging.
Just keep digging. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Pauly Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.